case for argument is Travelers Casualty v. Wells Fargo. Mr. Wilson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Mark Wilson on behalf of the plaintiff appellant. I'd like to address two things this morning, Your Honor. First, the Mutual Service v. Elizabeth State Bank case and how it might apply to these facts, and secondly, the findings of the district court and why we believe they are inconsistent. First of all, the Mutual Service versus Elizabeth State Bank case. The district court held that Mutual Service applied to this case, and so it's appropriate to look at what the holding of Mutual Service was. And the holding of Mutual Service versus Elizabeth State Bank was that the payee bank in that case, and it was a bank in that case, the payee bank had a duty of inquiry upon it to make an inquiry of the drawer, and those were the words of this court, an inquiry of the drawer with regard to the check that was made payable to it and deposited to it. And the payee bank in that case, Elizabeth State Bank, did not make that inquiry and was therefore liable as a matter of law to the plaintiff for failing to satisfy that duty of inquiry. And the court said that the bank took that instrument at its own risk. Now, the district court in this case agreed that the decision in Mutual Service would...
It's not a question of taking the instrument, but to whom the credit on the instrument is given. Right, checked, written by A, and it says pay to the order of B. It's handed over to B by C, and C says pay me. Right, B has no reason other than to think that C is a thief of the instrument. Right, found it in the mail, ripped the envelope open, stole it, and showed up. Right? Why isn't B under an obligation to determine whether it can properly be put to the credit of C? That, as I understood it, was the question, and not just whether it was a good instrument, and so on.
Well, Your Honor, the duty of inquiry under Elizabeth State Bank comes from the face of the instrument itself, and the holding, as I understand the holding and the cases upon which it is based.
Exactly. That's what I'm stating. A writes an instrument payable to the order of B. C shows up. B has no reason whatsoever, other than C's say-so, to believe that C has any entitlement to funds under the instrument. What does B have to do before it can make the funds available to C?
It has to call A, number one, call A, make some sort of inquiry to A to determine whether A intended to give the funds to B, or alternatively, I suppose it could refuse to take the instrument. But it
to C.
Yeah, but here where Schwab is B,
yes,
the funds were immediately made available to C, who, for all Schwab could tell, was a thief.
Correct.
Turned out to be a thief.
Yeah, that's right. So Schwab gave credit to the thief, to C, and it did so without satisfying any duty of inquiry to the drawer, to A. And that is the fundamental problem. If B had either made some effort to call the drawer to see if it was appropriate to give credit.
Now, all of the Illinois cases that we've been able to track down apply this principle to banks.
Yes.
Any reason pro or con in the Illinois cases or comparable state cases to extend it to other financial intermediaries?
The cases extend them to apply them to banks, but there is at least one case that we cited that applied it to a credit union.
Well, give a reason.
Yes. The reason is that the depository institution here, Schwab, was acting as a functional equivalent of a bank for all relevant purposes.
Is that what the district court found?
It doesn't just beg the question. What we need to know is what sense this rule makes and how far it extends. As I tried to state the rule, you would think it would apply to any payee, wouldn't have any limitation to financial institutions. Illinois seems to think it's limited to financial institutions and maybe just banks. So I'm trying to figure out if the way in which I stated this rule was correct, obligation of the payee to protect the drawer against thieves, how does it get limited to banks? And if we assume it's limited to banks, why does it extend to anybody other than banks? That's my puzzle, which now I hope is on the table.
Indeed, and let me expound upon my point on the functional, on how this the Schwab was a functional equivalent of a bank. What I mean by that is that the Schwab took this instrument for deposit to an account of a consumer, of an individual. It sold the account, according to the record, as an asset management account.
The problem is this. This rule is unusual in imposing a kind of Good Samaritan liability, right? Because it's saying to the bank, you have a duty to protect people from a thief or a forger or what have you, for which you have absolutely no responsibility. It's like having a duty to rescue someone who is in danger through no fault of your own. Now, that's unusual to impose those duties in a common law system. Now, they've been imposed on banks, and the question is whether it can be extended to non-banks as a matter of common law, or whether it's the special legal status of banks that has resulted in the imposition of this unusual duty.
I would suggest, Your Honor, it is very appropriate to extend it to non-banks in given the facts of this case, because Schwab...
Skip the facts of this case.
All right.
We'll try to figure out what the rule is. Then we'll apply the rule to the facts of this case. Let's suppose B, in my hypothetical, is just Joe Blow. Right? It's a check to an ordinary on-the-street person, and C shows up and says, I'd like you to use this and give me an automobile, right? Make it a car dealer. C shows up with the check and says, give me an automobile, I'll give you this check. Is the auto dealer under any obligation to check, to inquire?
I believe, Your Honor, that you do not have to extend the rule that far.
Well, why?
And
so what is the principle that determines who is governed by this duty? Who is subject to this duty?
I believe that these cases are grounded in the idea that the public entrusts banks with their money for depositing funds.
But, of course, historically, banks had special charters, special legal protection and regulated entities and so forth, which I gather Schwab didn't. I mean, suppose you were walking down the street and you saw this check lying on the ground. You saw a check made out to Schwab. And you thought to yourself, gee, this is dangerous. Someone could pick it up and deposit it and so on. But you wouldn't have any legal duty to do anything. You just walk right by and...
If I were to find a check lying on the ground payable to Schwab, and for me to take value from that instrument,
you just see it lying there, and you realize someone's going to pick it up and deposit it, and but you're not interested. You mind your own business and go on from there. So you wouldn't have any liability.
I wouldn't have any liability, but I also wouldn't have taken any. I wouldn't have caused the issuer of the check to lose any money either, because it's still a check. Hasn't been presented or paid yet. But the problem comes when the check is presented and paid, and it only does that by being transferred to Schwab, and Schwab sends it through the clearing system and gets its money. In that instance, we're still in
Look,
the...
Look, on another aspect of this case, aren't you in terribly serious trouble because you never actually proved that there was a forgery or fraud of any sort?
Well, Your Honor,
we don't know who this fellow Carden is, right?
We don't know who he is. That's true.
Right.
And
I understand this affidavit business. I just don't understand that. How could you have thought you could substitute affidavits for testimony?
Your Honor, I wasn't the trial counsel, but
facility.
The collective you.
Yes, and the...
You can't walk away from him.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And my... What the record shows, in my view, is that there was an effort to work together before trial to stipulate to certain evidence. The stipulation didn't come through at the end, and the question then presented is whether or not these affidavits should suffice for evidentiary purposes.
But they can't because there's no opportunity for cross-examination of the affiant.
Well, that's certainly the underlying principle behind the rule against hearsay, except the residual exception is an exception
to that. Yeah, but because we don't know anything about these affiants. How do we know they're telling the truth?
I understand the point, Your Honor, but that's going to be the case with all affidavits that are submitted under the residual exception. And I think it is instructive that the district court found that that there were prior unauthorized checks in the same fraudulent scheme as this one, when all of the evidence with regard to the quote-unquote prior unauthorized check is the same evidence as this check being unauthorized. So I think that even the trial court indicated by that finding that these affidavits were accurate and correct.
I want to go one second here, just to set this up. I'm going to presume that the check is valid, just for argument's sake. And then it goes to, it's payable to Schwab. This person comes in with the check, payable to Schwab. Schwab takes it, checks, deposits it. And then when this person wants to withdraw it, it calls the bank, drawee bank or whatever it is,
right.
and they say, yeah, those funds are good. So as far as Schwab's concerned, they've got, it's not their money that's going out the window. They're already good. So then they give it to this guy. And I guess the question I have is back here, are we treating this as a bank? And secondly, does this... they then have an obligation to not just give the money to whoever asks for it, but instead to check with the drawer to determine whether or not that is the right way to dispose of these funds. And I guess it all collapses on that, and that's whether or not Schwab is going to pay or whether you're going to pay. Now, that's my summary of it. I know we've gone, I don't want to take up any more of your time, but that's what I'm trying to focus in on.
If you'd like me to address the point in response to a question, Your Honor, I will right now, or otherwise I'll...
Well, I don't want to take any more of your time.
All right.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Mr. Kane?
May it please the Court. My name is George Dougherty, and I wanted to address the two points.
Which one do you represent?
I'm here for Wells Fargo,
okay.
Your Honor. I think the appellant is in big trouble, and I'm going to address two points, both the district court's determination that the check at issue in this case was unauthorized, and then also the affidavit point. Mr. Kane is going to cover any questions you may have about mutual services. The district court made the finding, pursuant to Rule 52C, that the plaintiff had failed to present sufficient evidence, in this case, to show that the check at issue was unauthorized. This was a necessary element of his alleged claim, and one on which the plaintiff had the burden of proof. The district court's finding that plaintiff had failed to meet this burden is fully supported by the record, and one that is entitled to deference from this court. And, you know, actually in his opening...
It's kind of hyper-technical. I mean, doesn't everyone know that Cardin was unauthorized?
Your Honor, I don't know if it's hyper-technical or not. I do know that
well,
the district court...
Well, it's hyper-technical. It's not a very attractive position for you to be in, is it?
Well, Your Honor, I think we decide cases on technicalities all the time. The plaintiff had the burden on this point. At the close of his case in chief, the district court looked at this issue and found that he had failed to present sufficient evidence to show that this check was unauthorized. And I got to tell you, there was also evidence that showed under the cardholder agreement or the account agreement that the plaintiff had with Wells Fargo that these signatures may have been viewed as authorized. And that was certainly something that the district court was entitled to consider, to look at and weigh and make a determination on. So I don't view it as hyper-technical. And I do view it as a finding that's fully supported by the record in this case.
I assume that they're authorized, if we determine they're authorized, then you would then obviously say that, that Schwab should have checked with the drawer before cashing them, right?
I don't have a position on that.
You don't?
No.
Don't you have a cross-claim file?
The cross-claim that I had against Schwab was mooted by the fact that I got out at the close of the plaintiff's case in chief.
Okay.
I don't think Schwab's remaining cross-claim...
That's assuming we affirm that part, I guess.
Well, I think I'll be okay in the district court with that issue, Your Honor, because I don't think Schwab has much of a claim against me at all at this point, given what was pled. And I do want to point out that in their opening brief, plaintiff doesn't really contend that there was sufficient evidence to show that these checks were unauthorized. What he claimed in his brief was that the district court made a finding that the checks were authorized, and he said that explicitly at page 13 of his brief and also at page 24. And that's a statement that just misstates what happened in the record. And I would refer you to pages 79 and 80 of the trial transcript where the district court spelled out clearly what it was doing. That gets me to the second point, which is the affidavit issue. And I think he is in big trouble on this point. This is judged under the abuse of discretion standard. The district court clearly... properly found, I guess, that the affidavits were hearsay and it properly excluded them. The only basis for mistake that is argued in the briefs here is the catch-all exception to the hearsay rule. That's an issue that wasn't even raised in the district court. So our position is that that's been forfeited. So you were left with the plaintiff contending that the affidavits should be admitted into evidence, the defendants objecting to them on the basis of hearsay, and the district court properly excluded the affidavits on the based on the hearsay objection. I mean, it would be extremely difficult for this court to reach out and make a determination that the district court's decision on this point was so far out of line that no reasonable person could agree with its ruling. Unless you have any questions, I'll cede the rest of my time to Mr. Kane to address
okay.
the mutual service.
Thank you, Mr. Doherty. Mr. Kane?
Good morning. Ronald Kane on behalf of Charles Schwab. May it please the court. At the trial in front of Judge Kennelly to address one of the issues raised, Judge Kennelly said to trial counsel, what is obvious to you, counsel, is that...
Let's talk about the mutual services case. Now, so you would agree, I take it, that... Well, maybe you wouldn't, but if someone shows up with this very large check and deposits it and he's not named on it, doesn't that look suspicious?
No, Your Honor. This was
no?
No. In this case, the evidence, the undisputed...
Stranger one is in
do business
off the
with
street
you,
bearing a $300,000 check. There's no cover letter. He's not named on it. And nobody at Schwab gets suspicious?
You
have a remarkably naive staff.
I think what the evidence presented, and the only evidence presented on this was the testimony from the Schwab team manager, was that it was not unusual for Schwab to receive checks in this amount. It was not unusual for Schwab to receive checks that would be drawn on an entity such as this.
And with no instructions?
Health plan. The instructions came from Schwab's customer, Mr. Carden, who instructed Schwab.
Or the forger,
well,
the case may be.
Again,
we don't know from this record whether he was a thief or a forger.
This record, and one of the comments that I would make on this, before we get to the analysis.
All right, let's abstract from the facts of this case and go to the question that Judge Posner and I were asking, which is, how does one understand the limits of this Illinois principle? It is an exception to the Good Samaritan principle. It requires people to check for the benefit of third parties. Is it limited to banks, or does it extend beyond banks? And if so, why or why not?
In my opinion, it does not extend beyond banks, and the reason for that is found in Judge Rovner's opinion.
No, sorry.
In mutual service.
We do the best we can to interpret state law, but if you want to figure out what Illinois is, you look in Illinois law. Right. What is the rationale that requires banks to do this and does not apply to anybody other than banks? That's the critical question from your perspective.
And both in the Douglas case...
But give a reason. Come on.
Okay, the reason is that the rule derives from the unique position of trust that a bank...
But they're not unique anymore, because isn't Schwab trying to attract customers for checking services? That is, don't these brokerage firms now want their customers to make them their bank, write checks, and just as they would from an ordinary bank?
That's an ancillary service, no question, that all brokerage firms...
You advertise, you're trying to get people, so what you're really seeking here is an arbitrary competitive advantage over your bank competitors. They're subject to this duty of care, and you're not, so you will have lower costs. And what's the point of that? I mean, what's the sense of that?
Well, I think there's a fundamental difference between a bank
and a
brokerage
and
institution,
what is that?
Where the customers of the bank are looking to the bank
They're looking to the bank for checking services, and they're looking to Schwab for checking services, and you're trying to lure people from banks to use your checking service.
It's also important, counsel, that this is not about the rights of the customer of Schwab. This is about the rights of the drawer of the check. Under what circumstances does either a bank or Schwab have an obligation to the drawer?
And
to protect the drawer from Schwab's customers.
And we believe, under the rationale of the Douglas case, that it only applies to banks. That analysis strictly related to banks.
Tell me what aspect of the rationale of Douglas means that Illinois has a principle that stops at banks and does not extend to other named payees.
Because the primary purpose of the customers in depositing their funds with the bank...
Let me tell you once again that this is not about the rights of the customer. It is about the rights of the drawer of the check. So I don't see how the customer's purpose can be relevant. In all hypotheticals that matter, the customer is a thief.
Well, in this instance, the public in a bank is being invited to use the bank's conveniences to place its funds primarily
if you have fewer duties to drawers, then you will have lower costs.
More attractive to thieves.
Well, there is no Illinois case
that has applied the
rationale of Douglas. And the reason for that is because it's a unique analysis that should only be applied to banks whose primary function, unlike a brokerage firm, is to provide convenience of its customers for deposit of customer funds.
Why should that make a difference what the primary purpose is?
Well, because the public is invited to use banks as a convenience, as a place of deposit. That's not the primary purpose of a brokerage
firm. Why do you offer checking services then?
That's an ancillary service to the investment.
And your ancillary service is in competition with banks' primary
service. That ancillary service.
Why should you have arbitrarily lower costs or competitive advantage in this ancillary service in dealing with some company's primary service?
Because the brokerage firm's primary.
So what? The point is, you're offering a service in competition with a bank. It's ancillary for you, primary for them. But why should that enable you to have an arbitrary competitive advantage so that your ancillary service can grow at the expense of the bank?
I don't think brokerage firms have an arbitrary competitive advantage because they're subject to a whole different set of regulations than with the New York Stock Exchange, the NASD, and SEC than banks are.
The checking services are regulated?
The checking services, the receipt and custody and possession of all customer funds would be.
Are the checking services regulated by the SEC or the New York Stock Exchange?
To the extent that the brokerage firms are taking custody and possession of control of the funds,
they are. Are they regulated, the checking services?
To the extent that the bank...
I mean, is there a set of rules as to, you know, how you do your checking services, what duties you owe your
those wouldn't be
customers? Right. So that regulation by the SEC and New York Stock Exchange is irrelevant to this ancillary service of yours.
just isn't any regulation by the SEC.
Not as it relates to the checking aspect, but as it relates to the custody and possession of the customer's funds, there certainly is.
So what?
Well, again, it's a different analysis than a pure banking analysis where the primary function is the deposit. And then we get to the duty. I just don't think in mutual funds...
Exactly. For what it's worth, banks think that their business is lending money. That's how they make money. They view the checking account as a means of attracting money that they lend out to customers. That's actually the same use you make of checking accounts.
That's correct. Our position, quite candidly, is that the holding of Douglas and Mutual Services shouldn't be applied to brokerage firms, in particular on the basis of this record. They should not be applied to Schwab, where at the trial below there was simply no competent evidence presented that the check in question was in fact forged or unauthorized, and that
that counsel is why I keep referring to a thief. This rule does not have anything to do with whether the check is forged. It has to do with checks that are being diverted, completely legitimate instruments stolen from the mail, whisked out of mail rooms. There are all sorts of ways in which money can be diverted. That's why we don't want to think in figuring out the scope of that rule. We don't want to think it's linked to forgery, because it isn't.
Now, and in this case, Judge Cannelli, I think, properly found that to the extent that there was a duty of Schwab owed to the drawer of this check, Schwab satisfied that duty when it did two things. One, it examined the check for any apparent irregularities and found none. I'll note that...
Yes, but of course that's not the problem. The
no.
problem isn't the irregularities. The problem is whether why this person has a check made out to Schwab. That's the question.
And
that's why I keep raising the case of the thief. The thief is presenting a totally proper and regular instrument. It will be honored at the drawee bank. Right? What Schwab did when it called Wells Fargo was protect itself. It did nothing to protect the drawer, right? And that's what Mutual Services and its predecessors in state court are about. Not protection of the payee, but protection of the drawer.
But again, where's the duty here as it relates to a stranger?
Well, suppose we hold that Schwab is a bank, then would you still argue that your inquiry of Wells Fargo discharged your duty of care, the duty of care that a bank would have?
Yes.
To the drawer?
Because what Schwab did...
How did that inquiry protect the drawer of the check?
Because what Schwab was doing was relying upon Wells Fargo...
Can you be concrete? How did that inquiry protect the drawer of the check?
Only to the extent that Wells Fargo made the representations that these were good funds. Only to that extent.
Yeah, that means you got the money.
That means
Schwab gets the money, but they have the right to then give it away. If you said that this is Schwab's money and we can do whatever we want with it, that's okay. I guess you can give it
money. Schwab's customer was Mr. Carton, and it was Mr.
Not according to the check.
Well, no, according to the check,
Schwab was the one that owed the money.
Deposited to Schwab by Mr. Carton, who said, "I'm opening a new brokerage account with this $287,000." As pointed out in the brief, presumably, he could have had a settlement from the medical plan.
Well, why wouldn't the settlement check be made out to him? Why would it be made out to Schwab?
Because Schwab indicated as part of this process is it has its customers make their checks out to Charles Schwab's operation center.
Customers make their checks out, but Carton didn't make a check out to Schwab.
Well, he presumably directed the drawer to make the check out to Schwab, and that's
why. Why would anyone do that?
Why would anybody do that?
It's a policy that Schwab had to facilitate.
That I don't understand that policy. Why on earth would you have that policy? Since it's obviously a danger to have the check made out to Schwab, then you don't know whether the person presenting the check is actually authorized.
Well,
why do you adopt that policy?
Well, one could argue it facilitated rather than the
customer. I don't get the facilitated business. You make a check out to the person whose money it is, and he endorses it for deposit in Schwab. That's the way these things are done. What is it you think you're accomplishing by encouraging the by having the check made out to you without the endorsement.
Well, in this particular instance...
Not this instance. What is the purpose of your policy?
The purpose of the policy is to have fewer checks in the system where this check was just made out to Schwab.
No, you don't have fewer checks because it would be the one check. It would just be endorsed over to Schwab. It wouldn't be a second check.
And so if why is it over to Schwab, you're a holder in due course. So
well, and the court
off.
And the court here found that we.
So why are you? Why is it that you don't want the endorsement, which would eliminate these problems, or at least mitigate these problems?
The only answer I can give to you, Your Honor, is that it facilitates the process.
How does it facilitate
because
the
then
process?
Schwab gets the check in Orlando, Florida. It was deposited. It was brought to an Alabama office. Sent to the Orlando Processing Center, where they're made out in the operations. It's made out to Charles Schwab Operations Center. It then sends the check to its bank, First Tennessee Bank, and sets the clearing process where then it goes to Wells Fargo. And according to Schwab's policy, that facilitates the process. That's the best answer I can give to Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kane. And Mr. Wilson, how much time does he have? 3 minutes?
Your Honor, the question, of course, before this court is what is the likely, what would the likely results be of this case if this were presented to the Illinois Supreme Court? How would the Illinois Supreme Court resolve the issue of how this rule might apply to these facts? And I would submit, Your Honor, that the Illinois Supreme Court...
They'd probably deny the petition for review because it was mishandled at trial.
Well, procedurally, that might occur, I suppose. But if it were squarely presented, the issue of before this court is how the Illinois law applies.
Yeah, we know that.
Yes.
Get to the point.
And I would strongly submit that the Illinois Supreme Court would hold that this rule applies to brokerage firms no less than banks.
Why?
And here's why. Number one, there should be a consistency in the commercial law. That is a very important policy under Illinois commercial law and commercial law generally in this country. It makes no sense to apply this rule to banks, but not to apply them to brokerage firms when the brokerage firms are doing essentially the same thing. Number two.
Then why doesn't it apply to automobile dealerships?
Well,
automobile dealerships do financing too, right?
So, well, Your Honor,
why, in your view, doesn't it apply to every, say, commercial payee of a check, or every commercial payee of a check bigger than X dollars?
It should apply whenever instruments are being deposited to a financial
institution. Why, in your view, is that the limitation?
I would point, Your Honor asked for Illinois, where the policy was described in Illinois. I would point, Your Honor, to the Douglas versus Wones case, 458 Northeast 2nd, 514 at page 522. There's a good explanation of the policy, and to summarize the policy from the Illinois court. There is a marked difference between the obligation of a banking institution receiving funds and an individual. The latter does not ordinarily receive checks payable to his order from persons not indebted to him. He is not the custodian of funds in which he has no interest, nor is he a depository for such members of the public as wish to avail themselves of his services. On the other hand, a bank is all of these. That's the public policy of Illinois with regard to this rule. I would submit that all of those principles apply to brokerage firms.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Both sides, all counsel.